Now I would like to pass it over to Chris Ken. Chris Ken is the Assistant Governor at the Reserve Bank of Australia, a position he has held since December 2016. His previous role includes Assistant Governor, where he was the Chief Economic Advisor to the Governor and the Board. He also worked as Head of Payment Policy Department and earlier as Head of Economic Research Department, and he spent a few years at the IMF. Chris holds a PhD from MIT. With no further ado, I'd like to welcome Chris to the podium. Thank you very much.
Let me start by thanking Bloomberg. It's great to be back here. I haven't been here for a little while. So thanks for organising this event. It's great to be back at this venue, and thanks, Francis, for that kind introduction. Since May of 2022, the Reserve Bank's raised the cash rate target by 400 basis points, and that's been done with the goal of bringing inflation back into its target range of 2 to 3%. Tighter monetary policy is working to slow the growth of demand and bring it into better balance with supply. And this is contributing to the decline in inflation. So today, what I want to do is show you how increases in the bank's cash rate target are transmitting through to demand and then on to inflation. The most well-known element is what's called the cash flow channel. And that's where a rise in the cash rate leads to higher interest payments for those who have debt, reducing the income that borrowers have to spend on other things, and that leads to slower growth of demand and ultimately a decline in inflation. Now, the cash flow channel is felt with immediacy by borrowers with variable rate debt and then with a slight lag for those with fixed rate debt. And it's this channel that is being felt most keenly at present, with many indebted households and businesses experiencing a painful squeeze on their finances. And while this burden falls only on part of the population, there are other channels of monetary policy that spread the adjustment across a broader range of people. Indeed, in economies such as the US, where a sizable share of borrowing, particularly mortgages, is fixed over very long periods of time, these other channels of monetary policy, they do most of the heavy lifting. So my talk today is going to focus on how monetary policy moves through the economy in essentially three steps. So first from the cash rate to a broad range of interest rates across the economy, and then from those rates to economic activity, and then from economic activity to inflation. And I'm going to discuss the five main channels of monetary policy and the impact these are having in Australia to bring down inflation. So let me start with step one, from the cash rate to other interest rates. So the cash rate's the interest rates paid by banks that borrow from other banks in the overnight market. It's closely linked to other interest rates throughout the economy. When banks borrow at slightly longer terms, let's say of a month or more, they pay a similar rate of interest. If they faced a much higher rate of interest, they'd be better off just borrowing overnight in the cash market and then rolling that across the month. Going the other way, banks that have spare cash can leave that at the Reserve Bank and get the exchange settlement rate. And that's set just a little below the cash rate target. And as such, they're going to be willing to lend spare cash, but only to other banks as long as they get more than this ES rate of return. So for these reasons, short-term interest rates and the cash rate here, they're closely linked to the cash rate. You can see the three-month BBSW in green following the steps up in the cash rate very closely. Australian banks, they typically fund themselves with debt that pays interest linked to these short-term interest rates, the three-month BBSW to be quite precise. And therefore, changes in the cash rate have a direct effect on banks' funding costs, which are shown here in orange, an estimate of those, and banks pass those changes on to borrowers with variable rate debt. Banks have also passed much, though not all, of the rise in the cash rate to depositors as well. Since May of last year, Australian banks have passed on about 75% of the increase in the cash rate through to deposits overall, and that's in line with sort of what's happened in past phases of rising rates. In fact, the extent of this pass-through to deposit rates has been relatively high compared to other economies, which are also shown in this chart. So just taking a couple, New Zealand, for example, that's pass-through has been about 50%, while in the US it's about 35%. And among other things, this sort of difference may reflect the fact that Australia's banks focus very much on variable rate borrowing and lending. Now, the link from the cash rate to longer-term interest rates is not so precise. A higher cash rate usually results in longer-term interest rates and yields rising, but by less than the cash rate typically. And that's because other factors are affecting those long-term rates, including yields offshore and expectations for the cash rate and inflation just beyond the near term. And longer-term yields are more important for the transmission of monetary policy in some economies, and the US stands out, where a lot of borrowing is at long-term fixed rates. They're much less important in countries like Australia, where most of our borrowing is variable rate. Having said that, though, long-term interest rates still have an important effect on valuations of other assets like equities, corporate bonds, the exchange rate. They're still relevant to the transmission of monetary policy, and I'm going to come back to that in just a few minutes. So let me now take you to the second step, from interest rates to economic activity. So economists typically think of five channels through which monetary policy affects economic activity and inflation, and sometimes give them different names, but the names I'll give them are as follows. So I've mentioned already first the cash flow channel. Then there's the intertemporal substitution channel, that's often called the savings investment channel. The asset price channel, that's the third one. The fourth is the credit channel, and then finally the exchange rate channel. So I'm going to step through each of those. So the cash flow channel. When interest rates go up, households pay more on their debt, and they also earn more on their savings. Because that cash flow channel is so noticeable and so keenly felt so keenly by borrowers, it gets a lot of attention in Australia, where most of that borrowing and much of the saving is at variable rates. And even for borrowing that's at fixed rates, that tends to be at sort of 3 years at most in Australia, and that's quite short compared with many other economies. So since May last year required mortgage payments, so that's the interest that households have to pay, as well as their scheduled mortgage payments. They've risen from around 7% of household disposable income to almost 10% currently. And that's above estimates of the last time it got to a peak, which was back in about 2008. And the cash rate at that time was 7.25%. So for those households which have a large mortgage, their required payments are a much higher share of their own income. The other thing, and we've been saying this for a time, is required payments will continue to rise a little further in the period ahead as fixed rate loans that were taken out during the pandemic at very low rates, they reach the end of their fixed rate period and reset. The share of such loans has already fallen quite a bit, from close to about 40% in early 2022 before we started raising rates to about 20% today. So many borrowers have had to cut back on spending to meet these higher mortgage payments, while they're also feeling the pain of rapidly rising living costs. And you can see that here. This is a graph in the change in real household disposable income growth. So that weakness has led to slower growth in demand for goods and services, and businesses also with high levels of debt have also reined in their investment spending. Conversely, though, households that have savings, a net savings position, are now earning more interest and may spend more in response. And to some degree, this counterbalances the households that are spending less. However, the stock of household debt in Australia is larger than the stock of household savings. So what does all that mean? Well, since rates have been rising, the contribution of interest received by those with savings to the growth of disposable income for the household sector as a whole, that's the yellow bars above the axis, so that's positive income receipts in this graph. That's been noticeably smaller than the extra payments made by those with net debt, which is shown in orange. Moreover, people with savings typically spend less of any extra dollar that they might earn than those who have debt. So any additional spending associated with that extra interest received from the yellow bars, that's not enough to offset the reduction in spending associated with the extra interest paid in the orange bars here. So our estimate suggests that about 4 percentage point increase in the cash rate since May of last year, that's going to have reduced overall household spending somewhere in the vicinity of 0.4 to 0.8% per year through this cash flow channel. Studies imply similar sized effects in other countries that have high levels of variable rate debt. So again, this cash flow channel is less prominent in economies where most debt is locked in at fixed rates for pretty lengthy periods. And in the US, that's quite extreme. Mortgages are typically fixed for 30 years. And so that's why in this chart, even though the Fed's raised its policy rate by more than we have outstanding, so that's the average mortgage rate paid by US households, is really hardly lifted off the ground. Having said that, when rates are falling, going the other way, existing borrowers in the US tend to be able to refinance if the fall is large enough, while rising interest rates have other effects. At the margin, they dampen the demand for new loans. It's very hard as a US borrower to contemplate moving house at the moment because you have to pay a much higher interest rate. So that there's a lot less of activity going on there. The turnover in the housing market declines a lot, and that's reducing a range of other associated spending every time you move house. Monetary policy is still effective in such economies, including through the cash flow channel, but it's just the cash flow channel operates monetary policy operates more intensively via other policies in these economies. So the next channel is the intertemporal substitution channel. So here, changes in interest rates affecting the incentive to spend versus saving. So that's the intertemporal substitution channel, sometimes called the savings investment channel. For businesses, the interest rate affects the cost of their capital, and that helps determine whether and when they're going to invest. And for households, higher interest rates provide an incentive to save more today, postpone consumption, postpone dwelling investment until another time. There's, on the business side, mixed evidence on the extent to which interest rates affect business investment in Australia, at least directly. It's pretty difficult to find those relationships in the aggregate data. But what you can do is look at firm-level data, and there you can see that business investment responds to changing interest rates. Our recent model estimates imply that the 4 percentage point increase in the cash rate might contribute to business investment being around 4% lower than it otherwise would have been after about 2 or 3 years. Still on the intertemporal channel, the dwelling investment, that typically responds pretty quickly to changes in interest rates. Fewer homes are built, renovation activity declines when interest rates rise noticeably. And that's the intertemporal substitution channel at work. People are saving their money, putting off major spending to a later date. Having said that, the other channels I mentioned in a minute, asset price and credit channels, they're likely to be at play here as well. So in the current cycle, higher interest rates may have also played a role in slowing the rate at which households have run down the sizable stock of additional savings that they accumulated during the pandemic. So you can see in gross savings rate, the additional savings was well above the average prior to the pandemic, shown in the red dashed line here. So that's extra savings that they made at that time. So a slower rundown of that would contribute to a slower growth of consumption than otherwise would have been the case. In fact, household savings ratio in Australia, you can see, has only recently dipped below this pre-pandemic average after having been well above it for quite some time. So let me next turn to the asset price channel. So rising interest rates contributes to much lower asset prices, and this is because asset prices, so shares, bonds, housing, for example, they depend very much on the discounted value of all the expected future cash flows that they will produce. So a rise in interest rates increases the discount factor and hence lowers asset prices and in turn household wealth. And while the details are going to vary, empirical studies suggest that changes in wealth do lead to changes in consumption. And for Australia, the various estimates suggest that each 1% decline in wealth results in a fall in consumption of around 0.1 to 0.2%, and that's well within the range of what it is for other economies. But look, other factors are having an impact on asset prices besides just monetary policy. So, in fact, while housing prices in Australia had declined during that initial period of raising interest rates and tightening monetary policy through 2022, they've been rising over much of this year, even though credit growth has slowed and monetary policy has been tightened further. I think that's likely to owe at least in part to the surge in population growth in combination with relatively low level of new construction. The credit channel. So higher interest rates also reduce the supply of loans to households, the availability of external funding to businesses. So that's the credit channel. Higher interest rates, they tend to make lending a little bit more risky, especially to lower net worth borrowers. And it also makes it more costly for businesses to borrow at a time when weaker economic conditions are likely to be weighing on their ability to generate revenue. So increases in the riskiness of the underlying loans as well, that's going to raise the cost at the margin to banks for their funding, at least from wholesale sources. So to the extent that some households and some businesses, they're going to be offered smaller loans than they otherwise would have preferred and on less favourable terms, that's going to result in less borrowing. That's going to slow the growth of overall demand. One way that the credit channel operates in Australia is via the so-called serviceability assessment. So this is something that banks apply when they're trying to decide how much they're going to lend to a prospective borrower that shows up. Under these assessments, the increase in the cash rate has seen borrowing capacity for a typical household fall by something like 30%, and accordingly, housing loan commitments shown here, they've fallen by around the same amount since early 2022. They've picked up at just a touch since February, but it's only a touch. So the final channel that I want to talk about is the exchange rate channel. So that channel can be particularly important for a small open economy like Australia. All else equal, and just remember that, I'm going to come back to that, all else equal, a rise in Australian interest rates relative to rates offshore, that's going to increase the demand for Australian assets, and that's going to increase the value of the Aussie dollar. Now, by itself, an appreciation of the Aussie dollar, that's going to reduce the prices Australians pay for foreign goods and services. It's also going to increase prices that foreigners pay for goods and services produced here. So an appreciation of the Australian dollar, that contributes directly to lower Australian inflation because it directly helps to reduce the price of imports. It also would encourage both Australians and foreigners to divert some of their spending from goods and services that are produced here at the margin, divert some of that to goods and services produced offshore. In the context of high inflation and demand that's greater than supply, the economy's capacity to supply goods and services, that sort of diversion would be helpful. But of course, I ask you to remember the all else equal part, not everything else is equal. Australian interest rates have been rising to combat inflation, but interest rates overseas have been rising for the same reason. And as a result, despite increases in rates of 400 basis points, the Australian dollar has depreciated by just a little over 2% on a trade-weighted basis since that time. Other global developments have played a role here, right? In particular, over recent months, there's been rising concerns about the economic outlook for China, which is a major user of Australian commodities. It's our largest trading partner. Nevertheless, I think I would assert that by raising the cash rate, monetary policy has at least helped to underpin, support the value of the Australian dollar in the face of all these other movements. So we're on to step three. From economic activity to inflation. So the first step from cash rate to other interest rates, the exchange rate, that's pretty quick. The second step takes a bit more time, changes in interest rates affecting the growth of demand via those channels I've talked about. The third step, the link to inflation, takes longer still, with growth in demand typically slowing before there's a broad-based decline in inflation. The past year or so has been something of an exception to that, given that some of the sharp initial increase in inflation and then the subsequent decline has reflected problems in global supply chains that are either now resolved or at least improving. Nevertheless, the effect of slower demand on growth of inflation is building. For example, we're hearing in liaison from a range of retailers that are discounting prices now in the face of weaker consumer spending. So it's worth asking which channel matters most. It's a good question. The trouble is it's very hard to gauge the strength of these different channels because they operate at the same time and we only observe the net effects. But there is empirical evidence for the importance of each channel on different elements of demand or inflation. We also know that monetary policy is effective in countries that have a much weaker cash flow channel than Australia. So again, the significant increases in policy rates in Australia and the US, for comparison, are contributing to broadly similar, not the same, but broadly similar changes in key macroeconomic indicators. In particular, you can see here in this chart, the growth in domestic demand has moderated in both economies. Labour market conditions are easing, and you can see that by the decline in job vacancies shown as a share of unemployment. And inflation's declined, and you can measure that in lots of different ways. We've, for ease of comparison, done that in core terms here. So let me conclude. The cash flow channel is the obvious way in which monetary policy is transmitted through to aggregate demand and inflation in Australia. Compared to earlier episodes of rising rates, this channel maybe has been operating with a slight delay given that initial high share of fixed rate loans that I talked about. But around half of all of the loans that were fixed at very low rates during the pandemic, they've now rolled off. And most of the rest are going to do so over the next 12 months or so. So required mortgage payments that are a record share of household disposable income, and they're going to rise further as more fixed rate loans expire. So this cash flow channel is felt acutely by those with variable rate debt. But there are these other channels of monetary policy. And in particular, the rise in interest rates has increased incentives to save. And that's true for households that have already got a lot of savings during the pandemic. And households with debt, they also have an incentive to save. They can possibly do this if they're able to pay down their debts just a bit ahead of schedule. Or at least if they do have savings buffers, run those down a bit more slowly than otherwise. So these and other channels of monetary policy are slowing the growth of demand, and that's contributing to a decline in inflation. The lags in transmission, the normal lags in transmission of monetary policy, mean that some further effect of the rate increases that we've pursued to date, they're still to be felt through the economy, and that's going to provide further impetus to lower inflation in the period ahead. Meanwhile, the board's paying very close attention to economic developments here, offshore. And some further tightening in monetary policy may be required to ensure that inflation, which is still too high, returns to target in a reasonable time frame. So thank you very much for listening. I think we're going to hand over to some questions, but we're all in the hands of Swati. So Swati, thank you. Cheers.
Thank you, Chris. So I'll start with a few questions and then I'll open the floor to our guests to ask questions. Just a housekeeping reminder, when you ask a question, please spell out your full name and the organization you're representing, and then ask your question. We'll first take questions from our guests and then we'll go to media. Chris, the lags in transmission still being felt in the economy, does that mean that no more rate hikes? We are at peak now?
Yeah, the interest rate question, it's a good question. I'm going to step back for a minute and describe what I think are broadly three parts to the phase we're in of raising rates. The first part was a quick, very quick and strong recovery in demand following the pandemic, that was accompanied by some pretty severe supply shocks. So that led to very high inflation, demand well in excess of supply. So that was a story of taking away the very stimulatory monetary policy settings and raising rates pretty quickly. That's the first part. The second part, I think, then followed when we were trying to get rates a little bit more slowly, but still trying to get rates into restrictive territory. And I think in my speech, I tried to convey the fact that I think we're there. We know demand growth slowing, inflation's falling, labour market conditions are easing. Lags in policy, as you said, mean there's still some further effects. And now I think it's possible, having done that, to be in this third phase, if you like, of that, where we have an opportunity to see how the economy and how the data is evolving. The board's going to be very much focused on those things I mentioned, global developments, trends in household spending, what's happening in the labour market, and ultimately the outlook, in other words, the forecast for inflation and economic activity. And as I said, they've noted after the most recent meeting, some further rate rise might be needed. I think it's important to recognise, you know, because inflation is such a problem, high inflation for all Australians, it's important to try and get inflation back into the target in a reasonable time frame. But look, we've made quite a bit also of the fact that the board is mindful of trying to retain as much of the employment growth as possible, because that's really critical for Australian welfare as well.
So another way which economists have pointed out that you can still tighten monetary conditions is if you do active quantitative tightening. There was widespread expectation that it would be discussed in October meeting, but we didn't see that in the statement. Do you have any update for us?
Well, some update, but not much. Look, we don't have any current plans to sell bonds to pursue what's called active QT. At the moment, it's a passive QT strategy. So we've had about $26 billion worth of the bonds we've bought mature to date. There's quite a bit more still to come. And we said back in May that we'd review that approach from time to time. A couple of the things that we're going to be thinking about is if we were to pursue a policy of selling bonds, we'd want to do that in a way that wasn't disruptive to the markets and wouldn't disrupt the OFM's issuance activity. So that's the first thing. But the board's also conscious of the fact that a large portfolio of shares still on the balance sheet implies interest rate risk that they need to think carefully about. So those are a couple of the considerations. It's not about financial conditions, though, I think, particularly because, as I said, the long end of the curve is less relevant for Australia, but we have an instrument, it's called the cash rate. When you're off the effective lower bound, that can do, you can move that around as you need to tighten financial conditions. The other thing, and why maybe October was on people's minds, was the roll-off of the term funding facility. So a big chunk of that, I think it's about $80 billion, was due at the end of September, so that got paid back, so that's great. That went pretty smoothly. We didn't know that going into, but we didn't have massive concerns, but you wanted to watch that carefully. That went pretty smoothly. There were some effects. You could see it in various markets. Banks went out and issued a lot of bonds, but they were able to do that pretty successfully. For a time, they were issuing a lot of bank bill swaps over that period, and that pushed those rates higher for a time. They've come back. So all pretty smoothly, but there's another really large chunk coming June of next year, by the end of June, another $108 billion. So nothing yet, but look, when the board feel the need to tell you that we've had another look at it, reviewed the case.
So was it discussed in October or was it not?
You have to wait for the minutes. I can't reveal what was discussed.
Fair enough. A global question. We've seen a big increase in US Treasury yields over the past month. And in recent days, several Fed speakers have come out and said that is tightening monetary conditions for them and doing the work for the Fed. We have seen yields go up in Australia as well. What are the implications here? And do you feel that is doing the job for Australia and for the RBA as well?
Yeah, so it's obviously quite a focus of markets and central banks at the moment, what's happening in those important markets. And there's two parts probably to my answer. I think the first thing is it's worth thinking about what's causing those yields to go higher. There are a number of factors. I don't think it's a sign of problems in the US Treasury market in terms of the way it functions. I think it's there are other things, though, a broad rise in uncertainty about the economy, about inflation. Some of that's geopolitical most recently, but broadly supply shocks. What's the path of inflation? How persistent it's going to be? What's the trajectory for growth over the longer term? There's considerable uncertainty about that. In the US particularly, there's been a big rise in issuance as well, at the same time as the Fed's letting their portfolio of bonds roll off that they bought through QE. So that's having an effect. I think in Australia, some of those factors are at play, but particularly not on debt deficits and issuance, right? We're in a fortunate circumstance where we're running fiscal surpluses at the moment. The other part of my answer is the long end of the yield curve, as I've already suggested, matters a lot less in Australia. It's not unimportant, but it just matters a lot less. Most of the funding here is at the very short end of the curve. So those sort of moves have a lot less of an implication, I think, for us than they might in the US.
Okay, cool. Opening it to the floor now. Okay, go with Tapas first.
Well, you said my name. I'm Tapas Strickland from National Australia Bank. Oh, thank you. Tapas Strickland from National Australia Bank, and really, really loved that speech, Dr. Kent. I was wondering, I remember a few somps ago, I think there was some analysis on the relative impact of the total transmission mechanism on activity and inflation in Australia compared to our peers, so such as the US and such as Canada and the UK. I was just wondering if that analysis still holds, whether you've reevaluated that analysis in the light of the research that you would have undertaken for today's speech.
Yeah, if I'm remembering correctly, I think the broad thrust of what we were trying to convey was even if the cash flow channel, which is what I was talking about today, is so obvious and quite strong in Australia and happens with some immediacy, if you look back over past cycles of interest rates going up and down, you don't see a lot of variation in the magnitude of those. If our policy was so much more effective over all of those channels and we were being hit by the same sorts of shocks, we wouldn't necessarily have to do as much, but we do. And that tells you cash flow channel important here, others net less important than other economies. I don't think that's that sort of broad assessment's fundamentally changed, but I'd also caution not trying to pin these things down too tightly, because any time you run these models, if someone comes up with a point estimate, they're missing the point. Should be telling us how much uncertainty around these things are. So more or less similar sorts of effects with slightly different timing and different channels, which is a bit the point of my presentation today. Thanks, Tavis.
Carlos?
Thank you very much. Carlos Cacho from Jarden. Thanks very much for your speech, Dr. Kent. Early on in this cycle, an argument from the RBA and the market was that wage-setting mechanisms in Australia were different to overseas, which is a reason why we didn't have to go as early or as fast in terms of hiking rates. It now appears that may be somewhat changing with the last couple of months of EBA data coming in with agreements setting at over 4%, and obviously we had a very large award rate wage rise this year and last. Obviously some of the other private sector measures have been coming off a bit, but how are you thinking about wages and potentially the risk that when you combine them with very weak or zero productivity growth, that creates upside risk for the inflation outlook, even if some of the other factors are starting to fade as supply chains normalise?
Yeah, so I think that my response would be that you're right, there are these pockets of stronger wage growth, particularly of late, that are obvious and quite prominent. But when you step back and you take a broader look at the whole market, some of those things are applying to small segments of various parts of the market. The broad picture, I think, is one where we've had a higher nominal wage growth than in the past of late, but it doesn't seem to be pushing higher. That's also the message we're getting through liaison. So it doesn't mean you're not going to be able to find examples where that does seem to be the case, but the broad aggregates at the moment are saying that's not happening. But as we've pointed out before, that's fine. the current nominal wage growth doesn't put at risk the achieving the inflation target, so long as we can get a turnaround in productivity. So our forecasts are still predicated on a pickup in productivity, which has been weak and even declining on some measures. I think there are reasonable prospects for that to happen, but that's just another thing the board's going to be looking at closely. The challenge, of course, is pinning that down in real time. The estimates come late, they're highly variable. A good way to think about what matters is ultimately what matters for inflation. So looking at inflation gives you a lot of timely information on all sorts of cost pressures, not just wages.
Thanks, Chris. This is Bo from Colonial First State. And you mentioned several transmission channels. Just for one of them, credit channel, just wondering, what's your observation and take for the recent development of private credit business and its impact on this, and especially the its impact on the monetary policy?
Sorry, I didn't quite catch what...
Yes, so...
The impact of which?
Private credit, because... Banks, obviously, they are, I mean, not as lending much as before, but many companies are lending directly to individuals, high net worth individuals and businesses, and I'm just wondering what's your observation and your take on this, and of course, its impact on monetary policies. Thank you.
Yeah, so if I understand the question correctly, it's about sort of new forms of credit and finance that's not necessarily traditional channels through the banks. I mean, the biggest non-bank source of credit is often through non-bank financial institutions that raise a lot of funds in by securitization. So they bundle loans together, and I know that's not necessarily what you're talking about, but they're kind of the next biggest in town. They generally, compared to during the pandemic, have had a higher cost of funding through that source. Coming off a bit more recently, but a higher cost than the bank. So their funding costs have sort of been going up more than banks, and so their extension of credit has been a bit less. But even that source, and I know you're talking about something different again, that source only accounts for about 4 or 5% of total credit. So the big story is still what's happening on the banking side of things. And when you look at credit, whether it's to businesses or households, it's come off. Households sitting around 4% annualised rate doesn't look like it'll push higher. Business credit's come right down as well. That's not just the credit channel, but that's the sort of thing you expect from the credit channel. So I think that's monetary policy having an effect, even if there might be some other marginal sources which are growing.
We'll take one media question from Peter.
Thanks very much. This is Peter Hannum from Guardian, and thank you for the speech, Dr. Kent. Could you perhaps describe a little bit about how the modelling on, say, the asset channel effect of higher interest rates, given that house prices haven't declined perhaps as you might have expected, now they're picking up again with higher population growth, what is that... factor in your estimation of where interest rates are going to go? Could we expect rising house prices to shift the odds for, say, another interest rate rise? How much more, if you like, would house prices have to move before your modelling changes?
Thank you. Yeah, so I noted in my speech you'd normally expect house prices to have come off, and that's what they did through last year, if the biggest effect operating on them is just interest rates. But there are these other factors. It's hard to deny that a rise in house prices is stronger wealth than otherwise. I think the thing that makes me a bit cautious about saying that's going to be problematic and drive consumption is there's so many other features weighing on consumption at the moment. And quite often, it's hard to really identify this wealth channel accurately and consistently over time because things are always a bit different. And the thing that's a bit different this time from previous increases in house prices is interest rates are rising. The credit channel's still at play. turnover's still fairly low. It hasn't really shot up. And that's consistent with the point I was making about if you're a borrower going out compared to before when we raised cash rates, the banks, which are the largest source of credit, will give you 30% less on average than in the past. So it's hard to see in that environment it being a major concern, but it's still something we'd be watching at throwing into the mix and influencing sort of the outlook for activity and inflation.
One at the back there, next to the pillar.
Hi, Phil.
Good afternoon. Rory Robertson, Westpac Group Treasury. Thanks for your talk, Chris. The markets has seen the Reserve Bank being on hold for the past 4 months and is wondering if this is the peak or maybe the Reserve Bank will go further. The expectation is that the Q3 CPI, I think it's late October, is something that could make or break a hike in November. You've said that the outlook for inflation is the sort of single most important thing for the outlook for policy. Is the CPI going to be enough to shift the bank, given the weak household sector, given the weak China, weak Europe? Might the CPI be important enough to make or break? Is it a little surprise you need, or on the upside, or a big surprise to get the bank moving again? Thank you.
Thanks, Rory. Well, you've asked all the good questions the board need to be asking themselves come November. Look, the CPI is important. It's the thing we're targeting. As I suggested earlier, it gives you quite a lot of information on a timely basis compared to things like unit labour costs, which come with a lag, measured not particularly well. It's not the fault of the ABS, it's just the nature of the beast, and subject to lots of revision. So it's it's absolutely an important thing to be looking at. But I think it's not exclusively, it's not the only thing we're going to be looking at, right? We have to put that together with the pictures of what's happening in the labour market. As you suggested, what's happening to the household sector. Housing spending is such a large part of total spending in the economy. And that seems particularly weak at the moment. The labour market, thankfully, is easing, and a lot of that vacancy is coming off. So I don't like to suggest there's just one thing and there's one threshold and it's a done deal. It's much more putting the whole picture together. We'll look at all of our forecasts. But that's an important variable, and that's why I think if you ask market economists, which we do and others do, Bloomberg have a survey, right, they're focused on November partly for that reason as an important meeting. The OIS curve giving some probability to that, but not much, and it's pricing a bit further out. So.
Cool. Maybe time for two more questions.
Thank you,
Phil.
Thank you, Swati. Thank you, Chris. So Phil O'Donoghue from Deutsche Bank. I wanted to ask about the interaction of monetary and fiscal policy. So, of course, last year, federal government ran a big surplus, first in 15 years, but going back to deficit this year, the Queensland is doing the same thing. If I look at the fiscal stance, federal and state together, and the change from last year to this year, at least on my estimate, it's about 2% of GDP in stimulus. The biggest increase in fiscal stimulus outside of GFC and COVID in 20 years. You noted in your chart also dwelling investment's very weak. The government's got a target of 1.2 million houses in the next 5 years. That's going to require the level of dwelling completions to increase by 25% from current levels and stay there for 20 quarters. Is fiscal policy at odds with monetary policy, and is that putting more work on the RBA?
Look, I think, our forecasts already try and embed as much of that as we can, both the federal and the state. I think it's great that you've mentioned, look, the state governments matter as well. And the states are also thinking about their investment programs and the fact that they're costing quite a bit. That's in an environment of high inflation and what they might do to slow some of these. So you're going to always be thinking actively about monetary policy and fiscal policy, but we try and take that stance as given. And I think it's important to recognise as well, you know, at least at a federal level, things like the automatic stabilisers are at play here. And you could see that in my graph of household disposable income, right? The tax take is something weighing on household disposable income. I think that's an appropriate sort of approach. That's part of the reason why in a strong environment of inflation, but also employment growth, very strong employment growth, that's a natural and appropriate thing to happen. So that we try and take all of those things into account as best we can, and we keep an eye on changes there. I think that's kind of already in our outlook for inflation to come back gradually. But things are heading in the right sort of direction, right? The labour market is easing, consumption growth is pretty weak. But thanks, Phil.
We'll do a media question here. And maybe one more after this.
Ross Greenwood from Sky News. I just want to ask about the target to bring inflation back into the desired band by late 2025. In the speech, you seem to indicate that, you know, there could be other issues of urgency which could even change that glide path in terms of trying to maintain as full employment as you possibly can. Can you just explain what things could knock you off that glide path in terms of trying to maintain the jobs while bringing down inflation to that target band by the end of 2025?
You know, I think that's some of what Rory was hinting at. I would step back from it all and say we often talk about our central forecasts, but I like to think in a world where we just, it's very hard to forecast. It's even hard to know where you're currently at right now. I think we've got a reasonable handle on where we are right now, but then by the time you go out that far, there's a lot of uncertainty. So it's really a matter of just keeping an eye on things as we go. I think in the past, we've made it pretty clear we would be not wanting to see inflation take much longer. But you'd have to add up a lot of different factors that would all move in one direction. It's possible that that was to happen to sort of for the board to want to react. You know, they've said they may need to raise interest rates in the future to bring inflation down. I think that's a reflection of the fact that we wouldn't want it to be much slower. You can tell all sorts of stories as to why that would not be the case. One concern would just be inflation expectations resetting if there were some further significant upward shocks. And you can tell whatever stories you like about what might cause those. But at the same time, household demand, as it was suggested, is pretty weak. And that could be the sort of thing, that weakness, that turns the labour market a bit faster, that eases conditions there and brings inflation down faster. So lots of possibilities, but I think I would be the first, and that's what I used to do when I was chief economist, emphasise just how wide those bands of uncertainty are, and it just means it's a constant job of just looking, monitoring, trying to absorb things. But it's not one thing that will do it. It's a mix of things that would set you off one course either way.
Cool. One final question. We'll take this lady here. Thank you.
Sarah Allen from Livewire Markets, thank you so much for your presentation. We've seen oil rises spiking again, geopolitical risks are rising. How concerned are you that we're going to see inflation spike upwards again at the same point as we're seeing weakening demand in consumption?
Well, those kind of alluding to some of the things I think Ross was hinting at. But if you put those two together, right, the effect, it could be offsetting, right? Higher oil prices, an important element, not the only element that goes into input costs and inflation, but weaker demand kind of works the other way. So I think it would be depending on the balance of those sorts of things. Remember, commodity prices generally, if they're high, including oil prices in gas, which is linked to that, that's generally positive for our export prices. So yes, not good for the household sector, but good for the economy overall in terms of our income. So you have to sort of think about all of that together. You kind of gave me an out there. It's just oil prices by itself, well, that's problematic. If it's persistent, if it leaks into household inflation expectations and businesses, but then if demand is weaker, generally that's going the other way. So you'd have to weigh all those up, and that's the sort of thing the board does every time it sits down and considers the forecasts. We'll be doing that soon. Thank you.
That's all. Thank you so much for your time, Chris, and thank you for your insightful comments and taking so many questions from us.